This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here at September with Kristen Dodge. So, Kristen, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Manchester-by-the-Sea, Massachusetts, and I say the full name now because people know what it is because the movie that came out a couple years ago. It's North Shore, North Shore, by Gloucester and Beverly. When I was fairly young, went away to school. I'm definitely a New England girl, so the weather that we get here is not too intimidating or uncomfortable. For most of my adult life, I've been between Boston, Rhode Island, and New York.
And Rhode Island was when you were at Brown.
That's when I was at Brown, but then, however many, 8 years later, I met who's now my husband, and he went to grad school there. After Brown, I moved to New York City. I worked for Cabinet Magazine, which is still around, and it's a great publication, art and culture publication run by Sina Najafi. And then moved to Boston. So there we go, Rhode Island, New York, Boston. And then I moved back to Rhode Island with Darren so he could go to RISD for sculpture graduate school. And then moved to New York City in 2010 to open my own gallery. And now we're upstate. But had we not had that path, I think we're sort of still in the vicinity of my upbringing. He is not, because he's from Idaho, and then his family moved to Seattle. So this is quite different for him.
And while you were at Brown, you studied literature and visual art.
I studied English and art, yeah. I was a dual major.
Studio art?
Yes, although you take art history classes and, you know, critical theory and mostly for me, I was interested in the studio aspect of it. And I actually was there. I went to Brown partially because I wanted to go to RISD, but I couldn't commit full, you know, to be in art school full time. I think I was torn between that, wanting to pursue art, visual art, and also, you know, writing. And so I went to Brown, and they have a program where you can take classes at RISD if you're a Brown student and vice versa. Now, I think it's a lot smoother, but when I was there, which was a long time ago, you really had to fight to get into a RISD class because they prioritize the RISD students as they should. And also, the time frame of the schedule, the calendar, was different. So I think Brown, I don't remember if it starts earlier or later, but it's like a 3 week difference. Anyway, I decided to do English full time as my major, and then I was also taking so many art classes at Brown and RISD that I realized, I think through my advisor, that I had enough credits to do a double major. So I did both, and I loved it. I absolutely love Brown. It was just such an incredible experience in terms of education, in terms of close friends that I developed, in terms of contacts that still today are meaningful, you know, for me professionally. Anyone that I know that has gone to Brown and I find that out, I have like an immediate affection for them. Unless they're a jock? No, that's not fair.
I notice that you write very well, if you don't mind my saying so.
Thank you so much. And so
you were always interested in writing.
Yes. That is, wow, you cut right to the chase there. Obviously, I love art based on what I do and what you know that I do, but writing is a real creative passion of mine personally. And if I suddenly had to make a major career shift change or was unable to be in the arts anymore, I would be a writer. So I think at this point I haven't pursued it enough. Little man, just sit. It's fine. Little man is under the desk. That is a dog. Anyway, so I do some writing, but for some reason, I don't carve out enough time to actually really take it seriously. No.
But now, for a certain period of time, you did have a sort of blog.
I did. Art versus Farm. It was on ArtSpace, published online. And I had two different artists illustrate the column. So the first three columns were illustrated by someone local, Nicole Vidor. She's a real estate agent who's also an artist. And she has her own office on Warren Street, which is the old retrospective gallery space. See, everything comes together. The second series of columns, there's three, were illustrated by Rhea Brodell, who is a great artist and is doing quite well, actually. They just got works placed in a a few institutions. So anyway, the column, I think, is very telling in terms of my perspective on my experience in the commercial art market in New York. So that was, when I was writing that column, it was the interim time between having closed my gallery in the city, Dodge Gallery, and moving upstate. And so there was about a year and a half where I had genuinely left the art world. And it wasn't a reprieve, it was a goodbye. That was my sentiment. And part of me still feels that way about aspects of the art world, but you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. That is really one of the worst expressions. It's so bad. Anyway, so I started writing this column, which was just a natural bridge between what I had been doing and what I started to do, which, you know, living upstate, spending more time outside in nature and having room to have animals, literal space, but also room in our lives, slowing down and having time to kind of reflect. So it was kind of a looking backwards and very present look at my very changed lifestyle. And I stopped writing the column. There's only 6 installations of it because ArtSpace changed. They completely shifted their whole business and no longer were allocating funds for more editorial projects. So that ended, and I actually started a blog, or at least I set it up, and I didn't even set it up, actually someone did it for me, to put those installments of Art versus Farm onto, and then to continue it. And I do have a 7th one that I wrote like a year ago, and just hasn't been put anywhere yet. It's not up yet. So it could be an ongoing thing. I think, you know, once I opened September, that's when that kind of started taking everything over, and I wanted to really focus my energy with very part-time staff. There isn't a whole lot of opportunity to do other things.
Now, how long ago was that? Did you open September?
September, okay, so I found the space and started doing the build-out in March of 2016.
So it was raw space.
It was a raw space, yes, and this is a new building, actually. And I was very lucky to find it and very happy that I did, because being in Hudson, there's a lot of old buildings and it's very unusual to find a space that is doesn't have old building character and problems. Like, the space is just open, more like a loft-like space rather than divided or having, you know, kind of supporting beams or anything like that. So it just is a natural fit for a gallery. And the space had sat here for quite a while, I think, before they found a tenant or what they wanted to do with it, because it doesn't obviously lend itself to maybe the other kinds of businesses that would be attracted to being on Warren Street. I would say this space is quite different from what is typical for a commercial space on Warren, and I'm happy to be on the 2nd floor with the natural light. And it's just kind of set off.
Yeah, it makes the light better.
It makes the light so great.
And I think you also said there's some other advantages to being upstairs. That,
yes.
The way it changes the traffic.
It changes the traffic. I like all kinds of people to come into the gallery. I'm not interested in only people who are only interested in the art world. So I've always, since I started working in a gallery in Boston early in my career, we were on Newbury Street, and we would get all different kinds of walk-ins, and I really enjoyed that, and I've always loved talking to students, and I think it's fascinating to talk to people who don't know anything about art, or who aren't sure how to behave in an art gallery, or wonder if they should be paying you, like there's a ticket price to get in. Which makes me think maybe I should.
I think there was a time when that was true. I mean, like when Frederick Church was telling David.
Yes, that's right. What a smart business person, right? He's an interesting guy. I mean, he's kind of like the Renaissance man, but a real businessman too. Right, so he would get somebody to commission a piece. They would pay him for it. So he had the money for the work. Then he would convince the collector, the supporter, to allow him to show that piece and charge people an admission fee to just see the painting. And I'm pretty sure it was one painting in a room that maybe had a cover on it, and he would reveal it, and people would stand. I mean, gorgeous, you know, amazing work. But what a smart business person. And then I think that would land him other commissions and so on, maximizing things from both ends. So anyway, maybe I should take a note there and start charging people to come into the gallery. Sometimes I do feel like what we do is a public service, that we operate a little bit like a museum for the people. Not that our programming is comparable to the kinds of things that museums are capable of doing because of their reach and financial, you know, standing. But this is a free opportunity for people to come in and interact with work that they may or may not be familiar with. And I try to have it be a mix. So they're, you know, in terms of bringing in local foot traffic, there are several artists that I work with who live locally, and some of them have pretty established careers, some don't. And I just think it's really important for that, you know, in terms of the people that come into this space, I want it to feel welcoming to people who live here and work here and have been here for a long time.
Now, these artists in the area, did you know them before you came?
Most of them, no. Jason Middlebrook is the reason why we first started looking at this area. I used to, as I said earlier, represent him at my gallery in the city, and I would come up here for studio visits, and really, my husband Darren and I fell in love with the area, and so 4 or 5 years later, this is where we ended up landing. But I would say there are other artists that I knew of that were here, and more importantly, I was aware of the fact that this is a very creative sort of hub, and that's become more and more apparent as I've lived here and discovered that. But, you know, I mean, David Hammons bought the church across the street. That's really exciting to me. I think he's one of my favorite artists. Marina's not doing her project for better or for worse, but that certainly brought, I think, people's attention to Hudson as a viable place to, you know, pursue what it is that you're interested in creatively, whether you're a writer or a dancer or a musician, visual artists. It just, I mean, what's your experience been in terms of like the creative community here?
As far as the kind of a scene where it's busy on Saturday nights.
Yeah.
That is really quite recent.
How recent would you say?
I'd say within the last 12 years or
yeah.
so.
I mean, I've noticed a difference since we were first coming up to Hudson, 2010. To now, which, I mean, that's an 8 year, that's a substantial time period, but there's been a real shift. The Basilica seems to be an important anchor point.
Yeah, I think the Basilica and also Helsinki.
Helsinki, yeah.
I think they also brought us kind of extra energy.
Yes. I've only been to Helsinki once because we live 20 minutes north and we have so many animals that have needs. I tend to not actually go out. So I work and then I go home, 6 o'clock, 6:30. And occasionally, though, I'll stay. And Jeff Bailey, who's got a gallery down Warren Street, who also used to have a gallery in New York. He was in Chelsea. I was in the Lower East Side. Anyway, he very generously invited me to an event at Helsinki that benefited Mount Lebanon, the Shaker Museum. And it was fantastic. It was, I think, 8 different performers, and God, it was. And some of them were very serious. I mean, they've had real careers, and they all came together in this sort of hysterical and earnest and talented. I don't know what you call it. What do you call it when you have a bunch of different types of performers coming together? Anyway, it was wonderful, and I would love to go back to Helsinki and see more performances there. Plus, one of the ways that I measure wanting to go back somewhere or not is how is the quality of their chicken wings. And I would say that their chicken wings were very good.
Now, you also have had some performances here.
Yes.
And that's something you intend to continue.
Yes. Initially, Amber Aceva, who is now a curator elsewhere, she worked for me, with me, and we came up with the name Arcade Block to kind of whatever, be the title for the different performance events that we have throughout the year. So there would be an overarching title and then a subtitle for each individual event or evening. And I kind of soon gave away with that concept, but we are still doing performance evenings, and I'm not always the one organizing them, which is really great. And that becomes a more open part of our programming. And that is actually another way, a way or place that I've brought in, you know, the local community, because there are performance artists, writers, activists, all sorts of people that have fit in with various parts of the programming. Like, we'll do a performance night in conjunction with an exhibition, often, not always. Let's see, Lauren Barnes had an event here a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was 3 weeks ago or so, that was all about kind of a non-binary view of gender, specifically different perspectives on femininity. And I wasn't able to be here, unfortunately, because I had some family things come up, but I totally trusted them to do the evening and run the performance night, and they had actually helped me with a performance night, a couple of different performance nights, honestly. One, which was during the incident report show that we did here with Nancy Shaver, Max Goldfarb, and Allison Strafella. And there was, I don't know if you call it performance, an event, an evening. And that was really incredible. And then before that, we did a performance evening in conjunction with our exhibition, Witches, and Lauren helped with that. But, and then our post-election show, we had a huge performance night with like 20 different people. But that was really, I think the performance evenings allow for different people to participate in what we do here. And
then you charge an admission for that?
You know, we don't. We don't. It's not a money-making endeavor. Performance art is, you know, tough in that way. But it does bring in more exposure for the programming, and it goes from being pure entertainment to educational to maybe somewhat activist, you know, involves in bringing awareness to certain organizations. So to me, it's worth it. And now the gallery runs on selling art, and I have 15 years of experience of selling art. I really enjoy matching a client or collector.
And I suppose you have a kind of base of collectors that still come up?
I do, yeah, and I'm building new support. But we need more. I mean, we need more support. People love that we're here, and I think we're doing really great programming. And I could have easily, just as easily, done the shows that I've done up here. I could have done them in the city. And the difference is we would have received a lot of press and probably sold more in the city. So it's not without its struggle to choose to be up here.
I would think that probably is one of the problems, is press.
It is a problem, and I'm working on it. I've had a lot of exposure or interest in, you know, me and my background or the gallery itself, but what I really want is exposure for and press for the content of our exhibitions, and to have it be about the art and the artists that we're showing. Both are valuable to me, but that's the side that's been missing, is reviews of exhibitions. And, you know, you're in the city, you just inevitably, it's easier for people to come to you. And yeah, I think people, I mean, I left the city not feeling that I hate New York and never want to go back. I did need a point, like a long stretch of a break, just because I was burnt out. But I find the city to be incredibly invigorating, and like no other place that I've ever been.
It's nice to be around that creative energy.
Yeah, it's the creative energy, it's the diversity, it's the noise, it's the movement, it's the surprise. It's a really cool place to be, and you can never do enough. I mean, that feeling can be inspiring or depressing, but for me at this point, it's inspiring. There's just always things that I want to be doing down there, but I never go for more than a couple days unless I'm doing an art fair. Like I said, we did NADA, so I got to be there for a full week. The Lower East Side, Bed-Stuy, those were the two places that I went back and forth for 4 or 5 years when I was living there.
And it was kind of a new art scene on the Lower East Side when the new museum moved in, I guess.
Yeah, which was shortly before I opened my space. And so I opened in 2010, And there's a wave of galleries that opened 2 years before, which was the year of doom. 2008. You know, I was talking to Candace Mady, who used to run On Stellar Rays and now runs Stellar Projects. And she closed her gallery programming about a year ago in the Lower East Side. She was on Rivington, which is the same street and the same block that I was on. Was talking about how she started her programming, you know, at just the absolute worst time, and kind of thought, well, I'm not going to sell anything anyway. So rather than trying to show small, attractive, affordable works of art like everybody else is scrambling to do because there's a sense of desperation and panic, I'm just going to do what I really want to do, which is to show sort of multimedia performance, cross-disciplinary, totally non-saleable works. But, you know, it's what she loved, and she's very smart and takes a lot of time to, you know, research. And I think she developed a great program maybe because of that time period when she opened. So anyway, I was 2 years after that point, which still made us pretty, you know, we were pretty there pretty early on, I think, in this sort of second wave that's been happening in the Lower East Side. There's a lot of galleries there now, and a lot of big galleries that have moved from Europe or from Chelsea. It's bizarre. But one thing that will never change is the Lower East Side will never be like a Chelsea, because the architecture won't lend itself to be that. There's always going to be Chinatown. There's always going to be many other kinds of businesses and types of people going from point A to point B or Z or whatever. And so it can never be a unified location with one primary industry. And that's exciting to me, too. My gallery space in the city, in the Lower East Side, used to be a sausage factory.
Oh, right. I read that, and you even have the sausage machine.
The sausage press, yes, was in the basement. And there were a couple of artists that wanted to use it to do something with it, because it's such a cool object, but there was no way it was going to be moved out of that basement.
Was that space pretty much raw when you moved in also?
Well, there was a business there that hadn't been there for several months, so it was empty. It was raw in that it was not a gallery space. And so Darren, my husband, you know, designed it to become a gallery space. And now it continues to be a gallery space, as Betty Cunningham is in there. So she moved from Chelsea to move into my old space. I think she recognized, like a lot of other people have recognized, my dog is trying to give me a ball to get me to throw it, that things were changing in Chelsea, and the energy was maybe more into the Lower East, moving into the Lower East Side. But I don't know. New York is always shifting and changing. And
yeah, Chelsea is not that old. I mean, it's 25 years or something.
Maybe. No, but because it was so successful and the surrounding developments that have happened, the rents are just totally impossible for a gallery and to be able to sustain. It's just, there are some spaces on second, third, fourth floors that have remained and been in the same location for a while. I really cannot for the life of me imagine paying the kinds of rents that people have had to pay there. And then also after Hurricane Sandy, just seems a bit insane.
Oh yeah, people were wiped out, right?
Just
and then the water
totally, totally wiped out. And what an extraordinary thing to have to go through, you know, for any business. But the galleries, a lot of them had basements and had, you know, storage. And, you know, these are all unique objects. So they're gone. They're gone. You know, but there, it also is a testament to how resilient and maybe it has to do with being an entrepreneur. I don't know. But a lot of these businesses, they were able to survive. And that week, it's like, okay, let's rip out all the wet sheetrock. Let's move all of the work, throw out what we can't do, get appraised the other works that we need to get appraised. It was just this incredible forward push of, I can deal with this, I'm going to deal with this, and we'll just keep going. Maybe it's insane, too, because you don't adjust, you just push through and make things normal again. But
well, obviously, you have the entrepreneurial spirit yourself.
I do, yes.
And you've said you kind of always wanted to have a gallery.
I always knew that I wanted to be involved in art. I didn't know what that was going to be. And I used to teach art at a charter school in Boston. I'd like you like I said, I was an artist myself. I've worked with artists. I've always been around it. That was never a question. But how I would be involved in art wasn't clear until I worked at the gallery in Boston, and which was called the Rotenberg Gallery, run by Judy's daughter, Abigail.
How did that come about?
I just was interviewing around town and interviewed at a couple different galleries. So there you go. I had some sense that a gallery, because I was also interested in business, put the two together, gallery. And I was teaching at the charter school, teaching art to kids, and I was at the museum school studying art. And so this was a third prong to my interest in, and which direction would we go? I didn't know. But my first day there, I sold with Abby, who was running it, a very expensive bronze sculpture. And it was just so invigorating to be able to do that and to have the experience of witnessing the excitement on the client's side and then the excitement on the artist's side once we told him that we had placed this piece. And it was awesome. And I just thought, but it was also, it was talking about the work. And these, maybe we were lucky with these particular people, but we really got into an interesting conversation. And, you know, my background, I can't even tell you how many, I mean, I come from a critical thinking background, like what I was focused on at Brown, but maybe I'm naturally a critical thinker, but also I've had an incredible amount of experience with studio visits, whether it was my own art or other fellow students' works. And that applied. It totally applied in a gallery setting. And so people were interested in learning about the art and having conversations. And that was inspiring to me. So I actually knew that day that this is what I wanted to do. And that was about 15 years ago. And so I ran that gallery as the director for about 7 years and then decided, with the blessing of Abby, to open up my space in the city. And that was quite a venture, really exhausting. I feel like I'm sort of still tired from that experience, but, and now I'm doing it in a way that feels right. It feels like the right level of output, and my attention is kind of focused in the right places, and right being, I guess, where I want that attention to be, like doing more studio visits, doing longer studio visits, spending, you know, more time planning shows. It's different.
When you do studio visits, that may mean going to New York or Boston, I suppose.
Yes, and a lot here, too. Actually, Allison Baker, who was formerly at Socrates Sculpture Park and then at the Aldrich Museum as their director, she and Candace, who I mentioned earlier from On Stellar Rays, and I did a bunch of studio visits Monday and Tuesday of this week. And they were all, you know, within the area, but really great, exciting artists who show, you know, in New York and nationally and internationally. So I do actually try to make a point of visiting with people who live near here. And that's, I guess, part of my interest in having an exchange with the community. But yeah, I do go to Brooklyn a lot and do a lot of studio visits there. One of our artists, Odessa Straub, she is based in Brooklyn, so I go down to see her quite a bit. And Boston, we show Sheila Gallagher and Taylor Davis, so I go there to see them. But yeah, I mean, Hudson, we're located, it's, you know, it's literally the same distance to New York, you know, from here to New York as from here to Boston. So in terms of artists, friends, clients, people in my past, I'm sort of situated in a place that naturally draws my past to it.
What do you have in mind for programming in the future?
The group show or a multi-artist show or more than one artist show approach seems to work really well because it brings in a lot of different people. And I get excited about the exchange between the artists and the context that the artists in a show create for each other. So this show that's up right now, Sit In, has 18 artists in it. And the next show will have 3, and that opens June 2nd. And that's Nicole Cherubini, who lives locally, Victoria Fu, who's based in L.A., and Carrie Moyer, who's based in New York City. So it'll be 3 artists. And represented in the show, I mean, in terms of medium would be sculpture, photography, video, and painting. So that's another, I think, probably consistent approach that I have, is that I'm interested in all different ways of art making and thinking. And someone recently said to me, "Oh, you love video art," and I thought, "I do," and it's true, I do actually. But I have shown quite a bit of it here.
When you were making art, what sort of thing did you do?
So all of it, everything. I did sculpture, painting. I did interventions. I did installations. I did a lot of, at one point, illegal projects that were political. So I really experimented with the whole gamut, and I'm not sure that I was interested in a lot of different kinds of things, but also I probably didn't pursue it long enough to hone in on a particular approach to my own practice, although maybe I never would have specified.
Looking through some of the artists on your roster, it seems like you give people, or people have, a pretty wide latitude.
Yeah,
I'm
attracted to somebody who gives themselves that permission. Yeah, and if an artist isn't pushing themselves and isn't taking risks, then it's not interesting to me. At the same time, I like an artist to know who they are within that risk parameter. And so they pursue something to a degree of, you know, deep knowledge and excellence and maybe affinity, you know, with a certain material, like Nicole with ceramics. She's a sculptor, but that happens to be her, you know, primary medium. Victoria Fu, who we're showing next, she studied painting, but she does video and photography. So yeah, I don't know. An artist who knows who they are really pushes a particular approach to making, but is open to experiment and not knowing. I guess that's sort of a general, maybe a personality of maker that I'm drawn to. I think there are a lot of people up here that are woodworkers, that work with their hands, or that are people who are interested in design, build, you know, pursue kind of that angle of making and creative thinking and problem solving. And Darren's definitely one of them. His business is called Snake River Design, and Snake River was near where he grew up in Idaho. So that's where that inspiration comes from. But yeah, there are a lot of people up here who are makers, designers, builders, kind of all in one. He designed this space, the gallery. Like, he designed the one in the city, but he doesn't like to take credit for it because he says it's a gallery, it needs white walls. Like, there isn't a whole lot of room for, you know, choice and decision making. But the wood that's on the front desk is from our property. It's a pine tree that we cut down and then milled and let dry, but probably not long enough because it needed to be done, and so we just did it. But so there's some elements of personal touch involved.
Betty Parsons' gallery on 57th Street was designed by Ellsworth Kelly.
Actually. Oh, you're kidding me.
It was so perfect. And then this guy who took it over, Jack Tilton, I think,
took it over.
And he took out one of the walls and completely changed it.
Ellsworth Kelly, he was up here. We've lost a few important people up here in the last few years. Oh, little man. So it's around 3:30 is when he starts whining and begging for dinner, which he's kind of the gallery mascot.
Now, what other animals do you have in your menagerie?
We have 5 goats. As of yesterday, 12 chickens. Before yesterday, it was 6. We got 6 babies yesterday, baby chicks. And 3 dogs, 4 cats, and 1 rabbit that lives outside and is, you know, rabbits are, they work really hard.
Oh, yes?
She is constantly digging and moving and pushing dirt and, you know, creating holes, and she has a whole network underground.
That's
keeps herself very busy. And doesn't seem to bother her that she doesn't have a companion. You know, Boston has really gone through a dry spell right now. You just reminded me of what's been happening there. Like, it's just a lot of galleries have closed, and there just really is not a gallery scene. And what's important about galleries is that we are the ones that are engaging kind of on the front lines with artists who maybe people don't recognize yet or haven't had the opportunity to learn about or see before. I mean, obviously it runs the gamut from that to more established artists, but galleries work a lot faster than institutions as we can, because usually there's one, maybe two people that run the business, and so you just have to ask permission from yourself to do something. But an institution obviously has a lot of different, you know, whatever avenues that they have to go through to get permission, and then raising money and time. So when a city doesn't have a gallery, like a healthy gallery sort of representation, then I think it suffers. And then all of the students, art students, coming out of art schools in that city suffer. And because there's no real outlet. And that's not to say that it's inevitable, because it is not, that because you go to art school, you'll therefore have a gallery show, but at least there's a place for a conversation to happen. And some of them would have the opportunity to show, and then it's a place to go and look and talk. And if it's just the institutions, I think the climate, you know, for art and experimentation really shifts.
Hudson has become a sort of a refuge for Bard students, it seems.
Yeah, and a lot of them leave and come back or just stay, which is great, because Bard is obviously such a great school, and you have these people who have had a very rigorous education creatively, whether they're makers or thinkers, staying here. So I feel like that is growing and becoming more, it's happening more. But yeah, Bard is a real resource for this area. And we actually at our opening had some people from Bard, you know, faculty that came, and I'm not sure what their connection was, maybe to a couple of the artists in the show. Some of these artists have been around for a long time and are pretty well known by other artists who've been around for a long time. So I think that was the connection.
Now, your post-election show.
Yes.
How did you put that together? Did you just kind of put out a general call? Because there were so many people.
There were 170 artists in the show. Please kill me. But God, what a cool experience to gather everybody, all those different, you know, voices. And the main kind of thrust was Kate Gilmore and I had decided a couple days after the election to offer a space for artists to do something, because she's an artist and, you know, I run the gallery, but I think we all kind of felt similarly that what do we do now? What do we do with this? How do we keep making? How do we keep doing? How do we keep putting on shows with this major sort of shift happening underneath us? And a lot of people felt depressed and unable to just move. And so literally a couple days after Kate and I talked here in the gallery, and I told her that I wanted to shift my exhibition schedule and create room for something that would respond to the current situation. And so we very quickly put together the show called Post-Election that was really just like reaching out to starting with all of our own contacts and relationships, and from there it spread. And it was not curated, it was not juried, it was literally, I'm not sure we said no to anybody, and if we did, it was because it was too late at that point. But I said yes up until the very last minute, and it was a great show, and we installed it in 24 hours, and it got a lot of interest and attention. And, you know, in some ways, that show represents a flexibility that I like to say that we have, and I'd like to live with this gallery, that you have to be open to things that come up around you and to be ready, you know, to be game. Because if you have everything so well planned out, then you're not responding in sort of an active, current way. And that's not to say that every show at all needs to respond to, like, current events. Please, God, no. But just in terms of the ethos that that whole project represented, it was collaboration, Kate Gilmore and I, brainstorming, working together, supporting each other. All of the artists chipped in, whether it was they shipped their own work or they came and helped install or they worked out the video kinks for the 12 different video artists that contributed, or they became a hub for other artists to deliver their work so that we could only had to do 7 pickups versus 100 pickups. I mean, it really was a necessary, like, collaborative effort and felt strengthening, I think, for most of us, for a lot of us through that experience. And then installing the show was completely insane. I actually wanted the subtitle to be Shit Show because, and that didn't go over well with some people. They were like, what? You're saying our work is shit? I'm like, obviously not, because we're putting you in our gallery. But it was just, and we did it. And at one point, Lauren, the same person I mentioned earlier, who's just been so clutch for me in so many different ways and for the gallery, they were working with somebody else and measuring in the careful way that they know how to install professionally. And I, within 20 minutes, came over and said, okay, no measuring. This has to go up. This was 12 o'clock on Friday and the opening was Saturday the next day. So we just jammed. And because of that spontaneity and just, it turned out to be a really interesting installation. Now, I would not want to do that for every show.
Who did the poster?
Oh, there were a couple of different posters. Lila Friedland, she silkscreened one of the posters.
I have the one with the upside-down eagle.
That was hers, yes. And then the other one, at that time, who designed it? I actually can't remember. It's terrible. Who was working with me? It might have been Lauren. I wanted to do a poster for every show, but it's not. It just doesn't happen, or it doesn't make sense. But that was a good one.
You must have had a fair amount of repairs to the walls to do afterwards with that many pieces hanging.
Yeah, Lauren again. My God, we need to dedicate this whole interview to Lauren. they came in and patched all the walls. There were. God, I hate to think, thousands of holes that needed to be fixed. And so that was kind of an insane project, one that I can't repeat more than once a year. Although then last summer, like within 6 months, I did another big show collaborating with Don Breeze that was at the Hudson Hall, formerly the Opera House. And Don runs Instar Lodge. She's an artist, a writer, a thinker, a doer, and so she and I worked together and put together this show that happened during the weekend called Rally in the Valley, that was to raise money for Planned Parenthood, and our show was called Act One, and it was 100+ pieces, postcard-sized works, and we raised, I think, $14,000 in one night or at least 1 week, because we sold a few after that night. For the local faction of Planned Parenthood here. Also another insane endeavor that relied on people volunteering and collaborating and coordinating and chipping in. So, and then, you know, this show is 18 artists. And then another one that I'm going to do. So I keep saying I'm not going to do all these big group shows and then find myself right back in it. But sometime in mid to late summer, we're going to do an exhibition that is all text-based works, and I'm deciding on where some of the proceeds are going to go, but I would like for that to be another fundraiser of some sort, but a regular exhibition time frame.
Now the show you have now, mm-hmm. What's the sort of price range for these pieces?
That's a good question. What is the least expensive piece? The least expensive piece is probably $1,000. The most expensive piece is probably $80,000? 80.
Wow.
So I don't expect someone to be a walk-in and buy they drop $80,000. But, you know, some of these artists, they have a client base and already have people that are interested in and aware of their practice and support them. So, but yeah, there's definitely a range, and that's based on career level for the most part. There was something I wanted to say earlier about the context of Hudson, the Hudson Valley, and the first American art movement. We were talking about Frederick Church. It's not lost on me that that's where we are. That's where I've decided to open this gallery. And I find that to be just maybe as like historically, it's inspiring to me. I do not show landscape paintings. And there are galleries that do, and you were describing earlier different types of programming. And I think landscape painting has somehow become synonymous with decorating, you know, your walls. But I actually do have a deep respect for it and attraction to it. And it's not at all what my programming is. But people do come up here for the beauty and the landscape. But I love this space. I really do. I love being in this area. And maybe I'm the perfect candidate for wanting to be around country farm life and also creatives and, you know, have a somewhat of a career, a business that is about being in proximity or as a result of being in proximity to the city.
Now, you said you sort of cleared the land around your place. Is it an old house or a new house?
It's a new house, but it looks like a barn. So it's designed after old barns. It's a one-story. So from the outside, you would more or less think that it was a very simple barn structure. And on the inside, it's a pretty open, almost gallery-like or chapel-like experience with a high ceiling and lots of natural light.
And that's where your husband has a studio?
We actually built a shop adjacent to the main house, and he works in there, which he's very content doing. I myself think that my sanity relies upon the exchanges that one has with other human beings, but he's perfectly happy doing his work, you know, in solitude, surrounded by nature, although the wailing goats at 4 o'clock in the afternoon aren't exactly relaxing.
Where did you meet, in Boston?
We did. We met in Boston. Darren drove across the country and was just looking for a shift in his own life and ended up in Boston. And we met at an art party. It was an organization run by artists called Mobius. And they would have events in different buildings every time. I think it was probably once a month and once every few months. And those events would have 25 musical, you know, bands, and they would have performance artists and, you know, sculpture, visual artists, whatever, all around the space. Just kind of wild evenings. And we met at one of those. I was dating the drummer of one of the bands and knew some of the performance artists, like Marilyn Arsum, who teaches at the Museum School, which is also where I went. I went there after Brown. She was doing this great piece. We kind of actually met through that performance piece. But the reason why Darren ended up at that event was because the Dresden Dolls, who were a pretty famous band in Boston, were performing, and they've since split up. But I don't know if it was more the Dresden Dolls or more performance art that brought us together, but the combination did. Huh. Boston has quite the music scene. A friend of mine who actually, by some miracle, is now a friend and good friend, she bought our house in Brooklyn, the one that I had talked about. And we hang out pretty often, and I visit her actually at our old house in Brooklyn. But she has Boston roots as well. She was partners with the singer of the band Morphine, and they were Boston-based, and I saw them at my high school in Boston. Anyway, all things come back to Boston, maybe. When we were selling our house in New York, in Brooklyn, the house, was that's where it was located, I intentionally put out a big book, a big coffee table book of the Boston Red Sox. I didn't really want to sell the house. The Yankees, Red Sox. Oh, that's kind of a fierce rivalry. And but it worked on her. It actually helped persuade her that this was the right place. It was meant to be. I went to a show that Lil Deb's Oasis and September put on together. It was an after party after one of our openings, and Juliana Huxtable was playing, and this is a very pretty famous artist, DJ, performer, and I think I left. I was exhausted at 1 a.m. and they still hadn't gone on yet.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I found out they went on at 3 or 4 a.m. No, not possible. But probably the Basilica is our, I mean, we talked about Helsinki too. There is a lot of opportunity to see live music here. I would like to do more of that. But can we just start earlier for us non-20-somethings types? I think one thing I do worry about with the gallery model is that it doesn't connect to enough people and can feel just not friendly. I don't know if that's the architecture, the whole white cube approach or what it is, but I think that's something that is just a challenge when you open a gallery space. And one of the things that I try to do to counteract that is to leave all the windows, the worn-facing windows, for the natural light, but also to have a visual reminder of where we are, the context that we're in, and you can see people walking on the sidewalk, other businesses. So it's not trying to be this kind of sealed, separate entity, but also doing these kind of active live performance or event evenings, I think tries to loosen up what can feel maybe more static in a gallery programming. I think our shows are very exciting, and a lot of people do, but still, we're not debasing this thing that we still exist within the framework of, which is a gallery, a white-walled, gallery setting. And the challenge with not doing that, I mean, my space in the city had a lot of character, but it still had a lot of white walls, but there was a lot of character architecturally. And, the work is always contending with that. And so there's a little bit of a match going on between the space and the work, and I didn't want that to be the case here. So this space, in some ways, is a lot easier to install. It's smaller, and their proportions are very satisfying and easy to work with. Art gallery in general is problematic. This is not a new statement. This is not a new sentiment. This has been something people have criticized and, explored alternative ways of exhibiting art. I mean, Documenta is incredible. The Venice Biennale. I didn't go to the last Documenta, but the one before that just blew my mind. And when I was an artist, I would do installations or performance pieces, that had nothing to do with the gallery space. But when you want to build a program, I suppose you can move from, so you can have a more mobile, exhibition approach where you do, Jesse Greenberg did a great show last year called Hot Mud, and it was on these artists' property, this property like right outside of Hudson, and it was a bunch of artists, and you walked around the land, and that's, so not unlike Documenta sort of things that you would see in other places. But to have to make a consistent case for doing, programming, and to have there be some linearity of development of thought or connections between shows, I don't know, I guess I've chosen to remain within a more traditional format. And we'll see. So far, we've been open for almost 2 years, and there's been a great reception. We've had a lot of people here from different places, from all over, not just Boston and New York. It's slower. It's not, the pace isn't as what it was in the city, thank God. But yeah, we'll see how this evolves and continues and shifts and tells me and teaches me what it's going to be, you know, in relationship to the community and surrounding context that we're in. I think what we're doing is, it's like quietly, our programming is quietly radical and seeks to create some change. And even if we're in Hudson, New York, I think people are noticing what we're doing. And hopefully that continues. I would like to be doing this for a long time, mostly because I'm not employable. No, but this is it. This is my life. This is my future. And maybe on the side I'll do more writing.
Well, Kristen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.